My wife actually stops me talking by holding my hand. So we're in company and she wants me to stop
talking. I can't talk now.
She just holds my hand and I actually grind to a halt. And now you're going to put that on the start of the podcast. Okay. Welcome to another episode of This Catholic Life. Conversations about life's ups and downs, big and small, how we deal with every situation imaginable, whatever life throws at us, but still manage to be sensible, practical, and joyful. Today's show is Music Matters, a conversation about music, the good, the bad, the ugly, what it's for, what it's bad for, and what it means for ordinary Catholic lives. I'm your host, Peter Holmes, and I'm joined today by Ryan Galliott, artist, resident Greek, and co-host today.
Yes, I'm hoping I don't have to sing on this episode.
We're going to have to scratch that part. This is joking. We're talking about music, not necessarily claiming to be musicians. And we're also joined today by Tara Vaness, student of law, philosophy, and dabbler in all things, including music.
Good morning, Peter and Ryan.
Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
You can find all the details regarding This Catholic Life on our website, thiscatholiclife.com.au, and subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, all the usual ways. Please leave us a review on iTunes. It helps other people find the podcast more easily. Let's dive right into today's topic. We should begin by defining what we're talking about here. What do we mean by music? Music is not just a clever arrangement of notes, but it is actually a thing in itself. It's an art form. It's been around as long as we have any history. There's been music around, and the history of music is intriguing. I recommend a book called
Reclaiming Leisure.
Reclaiming Leisure by Hayden Ramsey. Yes. He has a chapter on music in it where he explores the idea of music and how it was utilized. There was originally just everyone did music. Everyone got involved in music, what we would now call folk music. Just the common person singing songs at weddings, singing songs at popular harvest times or things like that, get really into it. It's basically music was kind of the soundtrack to life.
Yes.
And then as music, the whole point of music was the listener, the person who participated in it and how it evokes them to think about life, the universe and everything and go deeper into the meaning of marriage or the meaning of various festivals, etc. And then it kind of evolved into being about the actual performers of the music or the composers of the music. And they became celebrities. So Mozart and that sort of era became celebrities in their own right because they wrote very high-quality music.
I think I read something in that chapter. I've read that book as well. That said that prior to that celebrity, you didn't even have to play music. The simple act of contemplation on the music.
Yes. So you were, in fact, an appreciator of music, a connoisseur.
You'd still be considered a musician.
Wow.
Right. Yes.
Interesting. But what are we actually defining music as? I don't think we've defined it yet.
We haven't yet because it has actually, I think it's actually changed. It used to be just what humans did when they opened their mouths and tried to express either through poetry or through notes and things, the various interpretations of things. So in a marriage, you'd sing a song about marriage, which is an interpretation of marriage for the common people. When you have a composer, however, the quality, not everyone can compose like Mozart, and so the quality of it becomes much more refined and it becomes much more restricted from
but
the common person.
Even in the folk setting though, and Mozart, I still think there's an organization of sound to some degree.
Excellent.
That works.
Okay.
That's not a very good definition.
Well, no, it works in the sense that the listener can actually resonate in some way.
Yeah, there's actually something about rhythm that I think is a universal system that some things work and some things just don't, and that can be sort of pulled apart mathematically.
Yep.
But there are things that just happen to work, and that can be seen across all of time. So,
well, I mean, I remember in high school, I think it was along the lines of, and I'm paraphrasing here, it was pretty much an intentional arrangement of sounds. There are things that work in the arrangement, and there are other things that push that sort of abstract element.
There's also a communal element to it in the sense that there's a sense to which people can join the intentional arrangement of sounds, that they can either appreciate it by following the intentional arrangement of sounds or they can join in. But let's follow the history of it a little bit further. From Mozart, where it became quite specialized, I'm not saying Mozart was the cause of this, but it's one of the symptoms in his era, then the emphasis gravitated to the musicians themselves. And so their skill in actually playing the music, and quite often in bands, they would also write the music, but it was actually their skill in playing it. And even just in today's world, it's not even the person who composes it or even the person who creates the music, but and the person who sings, who happens to be the front person for the band or yeah. for the singer. And in some respects, now that we've got auto-tune, even that's not the issue. Mm. It's basically the person who's the face of that particular sound.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so what we've got away from, if you like, is these the participation at an ordinary grassroots level. Because, I mean, as a kid, I used to sing around the piano with the family and we used to sing at Christmas. One of my favourite parts of Christmas was we'd sing lots of songs together and you'd do it in raucous, ordinary, flawed tones. But now we're so used to piped music and very professionally edited and, you know, carefully arranged things that are almost perfect. It's, even our classical music now is very, very technically done.
Oh, I don't know if I would like to counter that just a little bit.
Sure.
There's actually pockets. It's not popular music, but there are pockets in this postmodern era of music where we're actually trying to pull apart things that we've done so well in the past, so deliberately intentional sounds that don't harmonise together very well right. in order yes. to make you feel very uncomfortable. So it's still to evoke something within you.
Can you give us an example?
I cannot. but I know there are movements in classical music doing this.
Okay.
And also in the sort of EDM electronic type yes, music yep, going yep. on there. But I know there is also work in classical form at the moment as well. So
now, are you talking about sampling there? Because in EDM, they often sample like a loop or a sound from another, like either from classical or from another song
sometimes.
And then work it into their beat. But that's still an arrangement.
It's still an arrangement, but I think it's in order to an arrangement of how it doesn't work sometimes. So in classical music, I don't know any composers doing this, but I've seen it on YouTube. Mm-hmm. but they do some really strange things with their instruments now with the violin. So
right.
I'm not too sure of all the terminology, but where you normally play, you don't play there, you play across like on the bridge closer
right.
to you where you normally should not play it. It makes screeching noises.
Right.
Yeah.
And weird things like knocking on the timber of the wood and things like this. So I wouldn't say all of it is auto-tuned to this sort of perfection.
I'm talking about the pop charts.
The current.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I would say actually as an extension of what you were saying earlier, Peter, that I think a lot of pop music now is no longer even about the music or the musician, but the listeners.
Mm.
And you get situations where people write songs and they won't play it for themselves because their listeners don't listen to them making that song. So
right.
they hand it off to other musicians to sing for their audiences.
Ah. Yeah, it's interesting. There's a few people, like you can actually trace most of the top 50 if you go through and find out who composed the songs. Often it comes
yes.
back to about three or four people in
yeah.
Hollywood, not Hollywood.
In the music industry.
In the music industry
wherever
who
that's located.
Sort of mass produce these hit songs. And the hit songs often have common denominators. So there's a thing called a millennial whoop, which is actually a little lilt in the singer's voice, which we should put a link in the show notes to it. But basically, if you look up millennial whoop, you'll actually find that a huge number of hit songs in the last 5 years have had this little lilt in them.
Do you have us an example, Peter?
I really can't. I'm so bad at this. But it's this little sort of sound,
mm-hmm.
and it catches you. It catches your ear, and you can't help wanting to go back and listen to it again. It gets stuck in your head. Mm. There's a particular song stuck in my head right now, and I can't get it out. I don't like it. I think it's a problem in terms of consent in sexual situations. But the actual loop is stuck in my head, and it's very clever in that way, so that they've actually, even though I don't like the song itself, I can't
get it out
of my head. And so they've actually succeeded in marketing it to me.
Yeah.
And the whole thing seems to be set up to catch my attention for enough time to get me to spend money on it and then pass on by and buy another one. Because if they could actually sell me something that stayed a classic, and that once I'd bought it, I'm constantly going to go back to that album and play it, that means there's a limit to how much they can sell me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I'm probably one of the bad people because I'm still buying old classic albums and playing them and playing them and playing them.
Well, this is also something we'll probably talk about it a bit later as well, but with a lot of the modern electronic music, it's actually made with the intention of replicating drug taking.
Wow.
Yeah, so
So tell us more about what does it replicate?
So this is for specific amphetamines like ecstasy or MDMA, all the party drugs. So you go to your big festivals like...
Oh, so it ties in with what the drug does to you.
Yeah, so you have a particular... all these symptoms of how the drug makes you feel when you're on the high.
Right.
And it couples very well with this music. And
wow.
you do it at a lot of festivals. So, for example, you've got Def Con, which is your very sort of hardcore music is what they... Hard style is what they call it, sorry. And then you've got other ones... What are they called again? Things like Splendor in the Grass, might be designed around a little bit more of acid. But yeah, a lot of, so then when you listen to this music, not at the festival, you actually find your body going through the same processes of what it feels like to be on drugs. And then you crave that experience again. So I think a lot of music is actually designed around the experience of what it can do to you now.
Yeah. It's kind of like conditioning.
It is. Yeah. It is.
It's deliberately designed to say that. Just a public service announcement. The drug taking described in this episode is not condoned by this Catholic life. We absolutely think it's a bad idea to influence your free will using these sort of substances. But it's worth knowing what they're tailored to. Now, what's interesting is that as I grew up, some of the more rebellion style music was heavy metal at the time. Mm. Now, heavy metal, or what used to be called heavy metal, is just basically called rock.
Yeah.
And it's more mainstream. In fact, some radio stations play it constantly, as it, and it's not a rebel anymore.
No.
And so you to be a rebel, you have to kind of find other things. I'm intrigued by, because when I was growing up, the songs had to be 3 to 4 minutes.
Mm.
Otherwise, they didn't get airplay, because it had to fit within the commercial stations, things, or you didn't get play. And if anyone's seen the movie Bohemian Rhapsody, you see the trouble played out in drama. You see the trouble they had trying to get Bohemian Rhapsody, the song, onto as a hit single, because it was so long. And they didn't fit the molds. I mean, when I worked in radio in Adelaide, there was a 2-minute song, Desire by U2, which you couldn't fit into the schedule because it messed up your entire schedules. Yeah. But it was a fantastic song, but I was told I couldn't play it.
Yeah.
What intrigues me is that Spotify, iTunes, and all these things are now the way people get their music. And so there's no longer the boundaries of the 3-minute song. But still, most of the charts are full of 3 to 4 minute songs because we're so conditioned ourselves to that.
Our attention span as well, I'd say, would have something to do with it now.
Except that I'm now listening to albums which have 16 minute songs and the whole album is, you know, a couple of hours in total. Or there's one where there's 2 tracks on the album and both are 30 minute tracks.
Who is this that you're listening to? Reveal the deepest parts of yourself, Peter. Well,
this is taking us down to the next question, which is what's called prog metal, progressive metal. I think that progressive metal is often more theologically sound and deep than most modern worship songs.
Could you just tell us what progressive metal is? Because there's a lot of different types of metal.
Yep. So progressive metal is probably a catch-all term for a combination, what used to be called melodic death metal. Death metal is a very hardcore heavy metal.
I think it originated in Norway.
Yeah, it's very Nordic, yeah. Yes. So Stockholm is the sort of the home of it. And it's mostly off-putting to people from outside because it involves a lot of growl, so the growl sound. Except that when some of the artists involved actually involved melodic elements and even operatic elements in their composition. And they I like them because they resemble sort of a Queen style of composition. So Bohemian Rhapsody that goes through all the different styles of music.
Yeah.
A 16-minute song by a band called Opeth, for example, they're definitely not Catholic, but they go deeply into questions of life, death, spirituality, what comes after death, the morality of various acts and the psychosis that's involved in someone doing an act and what it makes them is there any escape from that once you've committed yourself to something bad? And there's all kinds of explorations in their songs. And quite often bands like this, Amorphis, Catatonia, will explore mythological themes which then go deep into kind of spiritual themes. And because they're not bound by the structures of radio, they know no one's ever going to play them, they can actually get quite operatic. There's an Italian band which actually has employed a full-time opera singer to sing on their heavy metal tracks.
Wow.
And Opeth have beautiful ballads interspersed with their coming in and out of metal. And I want to talk about a particular song they have, The Conjuration, where you've got quite a soft and subtle, beautiful voice singing opposed to a growl. Like, so there's interchange, like antiphonally almost.
Interesting.
But the soft, subtle voice, it's actually at a culmination of a whole album telling a story. It's another reason I like the prog metal, because they tend to tell a story through the whole album.
Mm-hmm.
But the story peaks at this mental anguish of this person who seems to have done something wrong and is running away, and he's struggling with his own wrestling of conscience and guilt, and deciding what to do with himself. Does he end it all, or does he go and give himself up, or does he find out whether he's innocent or not? And then the struggle within him is represented in this song, and the subtle, very sweet voice is actually this voice of the devil tempting him to go the other way, and he's yelling back. Like, the harsh sort of scream is actually screaming against the sort of the sweet temptation of the devil. It's very,
sounds
very
like a
powerful
drama just captured into the music.
It's
form.
Amazing. Yeah, but I can understand it would be off-putting to some people, the style of it. But in terms of its sheer artistry and the variation of styles, and there is actually incredible production value, I mean, in terms of appreciating how they weave the guitars and the drums and quite melodic elements into these things, it's astounding. And they're able to go there because they're not restricted by the modern boundaries.
Well, that sounds to me like that's a progression of the traditional call and response within music and singing. And I think I know that I think a lot of African folk songs originally had that as well.
Yeah, antiphonal. So you're going back and forth, basically.
Yeah, and Bohemian Rhapsody definitely had something like that.
So. Well, it's just most crude form. You go to the cricket and you get Aussie, Aussie, Aussie. Oi, oi, oi. There's a sort of a primal joy in participating in a tribal chant. And if you're involved in a song, I don't know if it used to be that when you went to a New Year's Eve party, you had to sing K-San at the end because that's just the way Aussies do it. But now it's not happening anymore. But it was kind of a tribal thing that you got involved in various things.
Just a question for you. I was actually having a chat to a seminarian a while ago about music concerts, and he said something that shocked me, actually. He said he actually is really against concerts in general, especially, but he was speaking particularly about festivals like DEF CON, but in general, including heavy metal concerts. And he actually was opposed to them because he said, you've got all these people who are just losing their minds in the moment and they're nearly worshipping the person on stage. So I just wonder if you could comment on that. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I don't think they're worshipping the person. I mean, they might be. Certainly if you watch any of the old Beatles concerts, they're, you know, there's people screaming, they're literally idolizing them. But often it's about the experience. Well, I think we're actually, to be cynical, I think we're actually too individualistic to idolize an artist anymore. We're just there for the experience.
Mm.
Yeah. I was asking myself this question when I used to do a top 20 show in Adelaide, and I refused to put in praise and worship stuff into the top 20, even though it was selling well. And they said, why? And I said, I don't think it's a contemporary style because there was nothing like it in the charts. Mm-hmm. And then I realized there is actually a contemporary style that matches the praise and worship album, and that's the concert album. And when you buy a concert album, invariably it's of a less quality than the studio album. Like the singing and the music is all of less quality, but people buy it to grab that live feel. The way they felt at the concert, like the feeling of being in the tribe and singing along with the artist and getting involved.
I've never understood buying live albums.
They're
maybe
really
that's just
awful.
Me. Yeah, they're awful. I think just go to the concert or just listen to it on it.
Except when I get the Live at Wembley, the Queen album.
Were you there as
no,
well?
No, I wasn't in Wembley, but I watched it, and the whole experience of being part of a massive thing, doing this amazing thing and the set was amazing. So I think what we're buying into, we're trying to recapture an experience we had.
Maybe we could talk about that a little bit, the overwhelming experience that music can have on us, and whether it's good or bad, or whether that's its purpose, I suppose, to a degree, because it's such an interesting phenomenon that goes on with inside of us. I'm a really big fan of this artist. She's Danish. Her name's Agnes Obel, and she does very sort of melancholic music. It's very moody.
Yep.
And the thing I love about it is I find when I listen to her music, it evokes something so deep within me that it almost reveals parts of myself to me through her music.
Wow.
And I think that's just an incredible gift that musicians have and they can offer the world. But I know some philosophers in history have been really against the role of music because of its power to appeal to the emotions and really overwhelm
us. One of the Chinese emperors actually used to ask his provinces to send the latest music that they've composed, and he would actually then judge the health of the province based on if they brought him sort of sensual, sort of very much focused on the experience music. He would go, right, we need to get some people out there and talk to them. And if they went with, you know, the lively exploration or philosophical or the type of music you described, he said, oh, they seem to be doing all right. So it was one of the measures of knowing how healthy a culture was.
That's interesting.
It's interesting you're saying, Tara, that about people connecting with music. I think there is that emotional attachment that we form because music can speak in such a way, I think, that we think, oh, this really gets me, you know. And
there's a connectivity to it too.
Yeah, and when you find particular artists perform the same kind of song on and on, I've spoken to a lot of teenagers, and especially at that formative age, they say that they think that singer or that band really understands them.
Oh, when you feel that angst and this band just gets you.
Well, there's a reason why Eminem sold 10 million albums in 1 year.
Yes.
And it was very much, he was very careful. I mean, it sounds like he's really angry, but he's really careful about who he's angry with.
Mm. That's right.
He never picks on certain groups, but he does pick on the authorities, my parents, they're also awful, and women, I don't like them. And so he's quite awful in his lyrics, but he's very selective and he appeals. And when people say, I really like this, I ask, why?
That's true. The Blink-182 nostalgia of teenage years. Yeah.
See, I can listen to a particular INXS song, Need You Tonight, and I am transported back to the tennis game I played directly after my last HSC exam.
Wow.
And I can smell the flowers that were on the mesh, growing up, the vines growing up the side of the tennis court. I can literally smell it when I hear the song because it evokes such a powerful memory. Yeah. And you don't just go to what the lyrics mean themselves. It's what it meant to you at that time and where it put you at that time. And it's like an anthem for life. It's like a soundtrack to
our life.
And I think we'd all do that a little bit. Now, some of us, I mean, one of my most frustrating moments is when I say to people, what do you listen to? And they go, whatever comes on the radio.
Develop some taste.
Well, it's because music has such a powerful influence on us. Let me come back to your image of the concert where people are combining the influence of substances with music. There's another place where we actually have a substance which is actually documented scientifically to have a mind-affecting thing, and that's called frankincense. It actually it's a mildly antidepressant.
Really?
Yes. And so in a church, we have frankincense flying around.
Dude.
So it's like the church is the original rock festival.
Oh my gosh.
We have frankincense. We have music, which is quite deliberately churchy, so to speak, which sets the tone. And one of the purposes of that is to not be like the culture, but to actually demonstrate this is a sacred, literally sacred means to be set aside for a particular purpose, the place to meet God. So the artwork is different from regular artwork. The sound is different from regular sound. And the drugs, if you like, and frankincense. Now I'm in so much trouble for the Catholic drug.
No, you're going to get the kids into church, aren't you?
It is true. Frankincense has this mild antidepressant effect. So what about the rap effect? One of the things I'm nicknaming the Iggy effect is the whole Iggy Azalea thing. Now, whatever you think of her personally, she's an Australian who speaks with a normal Australian accent, but as soon as she enters into the style that she's chosen to sing, in inverted commas, she suddenly becomes this sort of African-American stereotype sort of accent, and she's doing all the macho, and I do mean macho in terms of the kind of the proud kind of posturing of rap music. And it's almost like we're trying to be something. She's trying to be something she isn't, and she's come under a fair bit of criticism for this because they call it cultural appropriation. What do we think about that? You know, is a particular music stuck with a particular culture, or?
I think that's something interesting. For a while, at least in the noughties with my friends, you know, the early 2000s, there was a conversation we had that I remember. We were talking about the notion that music and songs tend to not have an accent. Yeah. And I think it feeds into that.
I was actually just about to comment on that.
Yeah. And true. People seem to come into this generic accent when they start singing, but then that's changed a bit now as well with the development of different styles of songs over the years. Accents have started to come through as well.
Yeah. It used to be, by the way, that African Americans used to be the sort of the home of the rap culture, just as they were originally the home of rhythm and blues, and then kind of got appropriated via Elvis. And Eminem actually puns directly on this in his the Eminem Show album, where he says he's the new Elvis for rap. Basically, he's taking black music and making it white.
It's a hard question because I have sympathy for the cultural appropriation argument, but then on the other side of it, are we trying just to enter into their tradition with them, and does that have to be exclusive because of race?
Or could it just be that that's really cool? Like, for example, the African American music, what we used to call Negro spirituals, which is probably not the way we'd refer to them now, but it used to be called that. And a lot of these things have now come into popular Christian, just regular Christian, it's what they call praise and worship songs. So because they were so joyful and energetic and powerful, and the hymns sort of didn't have the same punch. Mind you, we just don't sing the hymns very well anymore. But in terms of different types of cultures, I think they contribute to it. Another one, if I can push it a little further, say Father Stan Fortuna. was a jazz musician, became a Franciscan, I think it was, and then was in the Bronx. And he used his musical talent to sort of use a way of talking to the locals.
I love that.
By rapping.
That's beautiful.
So he rapped. Now, that's great. And I really admire that. That's fantastic. And then he made CDs. And came to, and now all of the people who want us to look like they're really cool religious now feel like they have to do a Father Stan Fortuna rap.
That's right.
In Australia. And you go, dude, this isn't our culture. If you want to get into our culture, come and, you know, sing music
something
which relates
not quite
to us.
Organic happening there.
You're not telling us you're cool. You're trying so hard to be cool.
Yeah.
And even by using the word cool there, I've dated myself horribly.
I still use it.
Well, let's go to the mass thing. Can you use sort of modern music in mass?
Oh, this is a big controversial issue I hear thrown around quite a bit, actually. Look, I haven't read the Vatican II documents on this, which I know get referred to all
the
time.
They say nothing about it.
Really?
They say sacred music should be specifically devoted to devotion to our Lord, conducive to our focus on what the purpose of the mass is, all of those things, but they don't actually say explicitly, you can't use this music, you can use that.
Interesting.
Music.
I've been told differently, which that's very interesting.
I might be wrong about that.
Because I always thought it all depended on, I mean, the purpose of the music in the mass.
Okay.
And at different times of the mass, the music is meant to emphasize one thing or another.
Okay.
So it's
now I have a moment of existential doubt now that I've said that they don't say anything.
No, I mean, I could be, I mean, if you've read them, I would probably.
If someone's told you that, they've got it from somewhere, so.
Yeah, well, anyway, regardless, I have to put my bias on the table here. I am a huge fan of very traditional music in mass.
Right.
I love the Gregorian chants.
Yep.
I'm not a huge fan of, so in my parish, I had an experience where I live out west. We don't have great choir. And there was one mass in particular where I guess you'd say they were hymns, I suppose is the correct term for them, but it was with guitar, a piano and a recorder.
Right.
And it just didn't work. And I think it really detracted from the mass to a really detrimental point. And I've been to other masses where it's just the height of worship music in so far as it's Gregorian chant, and you're also feeling like a part of the tradition when
there,
that's occurring.
There is something about the pipe music thing, though. We're so used to perfection in our music because we have it perfectly produced and we're listening to it over, you know, iTunes, Spotify, that when we hear a slightly discordant note from an imperfect player in mass, sometimes we're distracted because we deserve better than this.
That's a good point.
But there is I think there's a style of music and an effort that needs to go into music. So if someone's making a genuine effort to do church music and they happen to fumble or wobble a note, that's fine. There's no, we're not having a go at that. But,
no.
But in terms of actually producing, I would say a folky sort of style, it almost plays down, like in an effort to be relevant, it plays down the significance of the mass, the difference of the religious service. But I would even go even further than that, that you're saying something with the music. And so even though, as I've now revealed, and I'm now in a lot of trouble I'm into the progressive metal, no way would that be appropriate for mass. In fact, on the way here as a bit of a gag, I listened to a prog metal version of How Great Thou Art, the old Christian. It was bad. And it's just, different styles should stick to their purpose, I think. And there are songs you want to sing with the guys at the football. There's songs that you want to sing around the piano at home as a bit of fun, or in the car or on the way on a road trip or something. And there are other songs you like to sing along with in your own soundtrack in life. But when you go to church, you want it to be the soundtrack.
I liked what you said earlier about, I think it was being sacred and then that's to be set apart. Yeah. And I think there's really, why not have this amazing music that is set apart and for that purpose of worship? However, I would like to just qualify myself. When I have experienced music that hasn't been the best in church, and it is something that I've struggled with, however, I always think to myself not to complain, anyone else not to complain, because if I want to do something, I have no musical ability, but I feel like I should contribute to that change instead of just sitting there complaining about it. And I don't know what that actually looks like, because they are doing their best. And maybe that's the only type of music we have available to us.
Yeah, so very maybe often the priest will say that. They'll say, these are the musicians who volunteered.
Yeah, this is it.
It's the widow's mite. The whole widow, Christ looked at the person who was pouring money into the coffers at the temple, and then he saw the widow put up two little coins into the coffers, and he says, that woman gave more than everyone else. Why? Yeah. Because that's what she had.
Yes.
And they were giving out of their riches. So if a professional opera singer comes in and does a good job in mass, it might be that they're just really easy and they're just giving a little small amount of their talent. Whereas someone who gives their all, and it's just not up to the standard of the opera singer, they're giving their all. That's the widow's mite. I think God looks at the heart in that sense. That's an amazing thing. But it's still music which is quite deliberately set aside for and written for, and I think, you know, has its appropriate place within the Mass, because everything's about focusing on Christ in the Mass.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's just it. The Mass, the Church itself, everything in the Mass, I think we've covered this briefly in the art episode that we did. Everything in the Church during the Mass and even outside the Mass is there to illustrate, to point to the Eucharist and where it is. It's a microcosm of the macrocosm, you know. And I think the music and its purpose in the Mass is meant to also indicate that.
Yeah, it's also to draw us to it, because if we're going to have it, and it's nothing wrong with having feelings about what's going on in Mass, it's just that if we come to Mass for the music, that's right. actually, you know, making the means the end. So it's, you know, if church becomes about the sensation, like a concert sensation, then in fact we shouldn't, you know, that's not what it's
for. Right.
So let's have a concert some other, put a concert on in the church hall of great music, that's fine. But what about so now we need to come down to Christian music, because one of the
Peter, can I just backtrack quickly? I'd like to just put in a quick little point before we move on from the topic.
Go ahead.
So Saint Therese of Lisieux actually has this really beautiful way of dealing with something that's annoying her in Mass, and she's talking about a woman, I think, who is always clanking her rosary beads, and it's distracting her from her prayer, and her way of coping with that, that I've now applied to sometimes music I'm struggling with, is that she imagines that it is a great symphony being played. And sometimes you just have to really enter into that charitable approach and realize these people are genuinely offering you their gifts and talents in the moment. And when you allow yourself to use your imagination in that moment, you open your heart to their music, and I think it makes it enjoyable or a bit more bearable.
I do that when I hear the sound of children in church. I imagine that they are, in fact, singing their praise to God in their own voice, because they're there and they're speaking. God's listening.
I heard someone say on another podcast that Jesus, when he hears us sing, is hearing us singing in our resurrected voices. So to him, it sounds good.
Well, good for him. Let's come back to Christian music, because Christian rock often gets criticised. And one of my favourite comedians actually criticised. They say, no, that's not for Christians. They shouldn't get involved in that. They wreck it. And I have to say that a lot of attempts to be modern music in Christian understanding. Firstly, a lot of the attempts to do modern songs in church, usually what they mean by modern is 70s, which isn't modern. Please stop giving us 70s music. It's no longer relevant to anybody except the people who were teenagers in the 70s. In terms of people trying to do modern Christian music, often it can sound really contrived and you know, schmaltzy. And often when I was working in the Christian radio station, the problem was is that they didn't want to ask the hard questions. And so a lot of the Christian music was, la la, everything's great because we're with Jesus. And it really got really boring, frankly. It was so boring.
Yeah.
And so I prefer music which is actually reaching and hard. And so some of the bands like Skillet, for example, as an alternative Christian band, is okay. One of my favourite artists, DC Talk, which then Toby Mac was the lead of that and became his own artist. He actually is prepared to, he's very slick and very modern in his style, but he's actually prepared to ask hard questions and really reach and push the boundaries in certain areas. So I find that edifying, not for church, but really good. Matt Maher's a good Catholic artist who pushes these things, sings about real issues and struggles and things, and that's good. But there's nothing wrong, like you don't have to have a Catholic who's producing art for it to be Catholic art.
That's right.
Sure.
And so, U2 is a band, their relationship with Catholicism is checkered, shall we say, but they actually do ask hard questions and they push hard, and bands like The Offspring critique capitalism really well.
Love The Offspring.
Yes.
Something that I find really interesting on the point of Catholics doing art is, I always think of Tolkien in this respect, and he didn't do a one-for-one analogy in his novels.
You can't spot the Christ here.
No, you can't, but it's so inspired by the Catholic imagination, and I think that's why his novels have such a more universal appeal than we could say maybe Narnia does for that reason. And I think it'd be really interesting to see Catholics working in that space a little bit more than just the typical sort
of producing good art that actually tests out these questions.
Yes, but not a direct, oh, you're a Christian rock or you're a Christian rap.
Yep.
I actually have, my husband showed me a rapper from America. I can't for life me remember what he's called though. I'll link it if I can remember later on, but he writes just normal. It sounds like normal rap, but it's a bit more wholesome content.
Right.
So there was this one line in the song, which it just struck me. And he was rapping about having sex with his wife and it's just because they're practicing for babies. And I thought, that's quite wholesome, you know, compared to what we're normally hearing about having sex with all these other girls.
Yep.
I just thought, well, you know, that's a good thing to put into rap. That's more wholesome than talking about having all these women that you're not committing to and you're using them for sex.
Yep. An unhealthy attitude to them, violence, all those other things.
Yeah, and he raps about other Christian things, but that's just one thing that really struck out to me in the rap song. And it wasn't cringe.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. Sometimes the cringe thing for me is like the Christian movies that they put out there. They're too formulaic. They're too nice and everything wraps up nicely at the end kind of thing. It's much worse than a Hollywood ending in that sense.
Well, I actually discovered this singer, Christian singer, called Mike Schultz.
Okay.
I'm not sure if you've heard of him, but what really attracted me to Mike Schultz is that his songs are about those really difficult topics.
Right.
One of them about just faith in general, how difficult is, he sings about it in the song, a preacher who's just sort of, it's become a grind.
Right.
You know, and this one he did on abortion, one about the sacredness of marriage, but the real difficulty of living as a Christian, as a follower of Christ, in a world where everything is sort of just temporary and, you know, I think it was a lot more attractive than some of these, you know, other Christian songs.
Look at the Psalms. We're going to have to do a whole show on the Psalms, but the Psalms are lots of negative, lots of anger, lots of, you know, waving fists at God. What the heck, God, what's going on? And that's real. That's the real reality of our Christian life. And it's a relationship. And relationships have ups and downs and ins and outs. And we hurt. And it's worth actually exploring those things in music. Mm. And I think some of the older hymns actually explore this quite well as well. They're really quite deep. Yeah.
So something interesting as well that I've had conversations about is some Christians will say, oh, I'm really struggling listening to this genre of music that I really like. Say they love rap. Love it, but the lyrics is really bad, can't listen to it anymore. And then you sort of aren't left with many options if you're taking that approach. And I heard a really helpful distinction by Father James Baxter when he was still at our university. And he said, well, you're still, any type of music, whether the lyrics is good or bad, you're still attracted to what's good in that music. Mm. So it might have a really good beat, or it might have that thing that's getting stuck in your head that we actually naturally like. So we're still attracted to what's good in the music. And we might even say some of it, even though it might have not great content in the lyrics, it's still excellent in the way that it's done.
Yeah.
But we could draw a distinction between excellent music and beautiful music. So,
But when it's done with skill to a bad end, that makes me cross because it's so well done. So for example, there's a couple of songs. The one I mentioned before is a song called Liar, which is actually about someone who didn't want to make love to somebody, and then their pressing the case actually makes them change their mind. It crosses so many boundaries of consent and all kinds of problems like that. And yet the song itself is so catchy that it actually makes you not realize that you're being drawn into this blurring of the lines of consent, and it encourages young men to press the case with young women when they've already said no.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a dangerous thing. Or the old Britney Spears song, If You Seek Amy, is really pitched at teenagers, really sort of, I don't know if you've heard it, it's a really upbeat, catchy song, and it's really hard to get out of your head, so don't go and listen to it. But it's quite deliberately manipulative, because the title is If You Seek Amy, but if you actually say it correctly, it's F-U-C-K me. So it's quite deliberately done, and the lyrics quite deliberately are pushing in that direction. But it's sold to teenagers as a kind of a jippy, happy song, but it's quite insidious in its message. So I think it's very skillfully done, and you can recognize the skill and the goodness there, but it's actually leading directly to a bad end, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think, I mean, even to a lesser extent than that. I was listening to the Guardians of the Galaxy soundtrack. By the way, some of my favourite soundtracks, being the geek
speaking
that
of transcendence.
And Pina Colada song. It's a similar thing.
Right.
I mean, it's about a husband and wife who were thinking about cheating on each other.
Oh, wow.
Right. It turned out that, well, hang on. It turns out all these things we thought about the other person, it's just because we didn't know these things about the other person. You know, and I was shocked. I really listened to the lyrics one day. I thought, oh, wow, this is actually quite horrible.
Mm.
It was a failure to understand marriage. and right. that kind of connection and listening to each other, a real conversation, you know.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I'd just love it if people thought about the songs they're listening to.
Yeah.
If they listened to the lyrics and actually had a thought pattern. Oh, I wonder what that means. I wonder where that goes. Not necessarily own the particular song.
Mm.
Like, one of my favorite songs is Hotel California, and that's weird.
Yeah,
it's just weird.
Isn't it about heroin?
Oh, it could be about all sorts of things. It's supposed, well, when my fundamentalist upbringing told me it was about devil worship. Of course, like everything else. I don't know. But to be honest, it's just one of those. It's like Stairway to Heaven. You think, what the heck are they on?
Good classic songs, though.
Indeed. But the style there is something you can recognise, and the whole sense, you know, the classic sort of artistry of it. Another one that's interesting, and if I'll throw this out there as a bit of controversy, one of the most amazing examples of modern poetry is Eminem's first verse of Eminem's song, Lose Yourself. And if you look this up on YouTube, you can actually find someone breaking it down that almost every word in the first verse rhymes with something else.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of those incredibly complex rhymes that actually goes in and out of itself and all sorts of sounds. Everything. It's not just ends of sentences rhyming. Almost every word links in somewhere. And that actually does things to you in terms of the way you apprehend the sound, because it makes you want to get into the song because everything's fitting in categories.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, I use that as an example when I teach the Psalms, because Psalm 1 is actually more complex than the Eminem song, because it not only makes the sounds match, it actually makes the theology match in all that complexity, which is kind of fun. Eminem didn't get his theology failed.
That's really
but
cool.
There's some lines that just get me absolutely thinking. So, for example, there's a song in one of my favorite songs by Catatonia. The song is Lethean. Which the first line is, how long is the pattern going to speak for you? And every time I hear it, I go, whoa, hang on. What pattern are they talking about?
Mm.
Am I just going with the flow? Is this a pattern of things that I'm just following the ritual of daily life that everyone expects me to say? Is this going to speak for me, or do I have an independent voice? You know, it's just this mind-blowing sort of line. Or just, this isn't one I relate to, but Taylor Swift's song, is it All Too Well, on one of her albums, I think it was Red, the album, where this one punchline, she says, call me up. She's talking about this guy who's, she knows all too well, all these beautiful experiences. And then she says, call me up late to break me like a promise.
Hmm.
And it just, whoa, in terms of the poetry of that particular line, call me up late to break me like a promise. So he's breaking a promise at the same time as breaking her. It's just a beautiful line.
Sits on your heart, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another example of music that I discovered very recently that has got me thinking is at the Powerhouse Museum at the moment, they've got a big moon installation happening. And they had some students from the Sydney Conservatorium sit underneath that giant moon and play a symphony. It was a beautiful experience. And they played an artist called Shostakovich. And he is from Russia from, I think, around the 70s. And what I learned, even though there's no word to this music, is that his music was actually written in a rebellion against the communist regime. And I thought, well, how do people know? And the communists tried to suppress his music as well. And I thought, there's no words going on here. But apparently at the time in Russia, they only wanted really folk happy songs that made Russia look happy and great, powerful.
Yes. Yep.
And he came along and he made really angry music.
Right.
And I think I liked it because I like metal. My husband and I were laughing why we liked it so much.
Mm.
I think because it has elements of metal in it.
Mm.
But it's just amazing that even in with music with no words, there can be such a protest and stirring of the emotion in human beings at that time. So,
Well, there's some music that just takes us places. Like there's a song as an old hymn, Abide With Me, which is beautiful. And it's wonderful in its message about God being with us even in the really hard times and the dark times and all that sort of thing. But I can't sing it because in regular circumstances, because it's always sung at funerals.
Mm-hmm.
And every time the song comes up, I'm at a funeral, you know. So basically it's so associated with that thing. And there are some songs that it doesn't matter what they originally meant, they're theme songs for something else.
Sure.
So, it's interesting what music means to us in that sense. Wagner is another composer who, you know, the music in itself is interesting and uplifting, and but when you actually go to his philosophy and the stuff behind it, what it represented was quite, you know, it was part of the Nazi thing, which is...
him and Nietzsche were actually friends for a while there.
Which is really scary that Nietzsche could even have a friend. That's a philosophical thing in itself.
It's interesting that you mentioned philosophy there, because I was reading something recently just talking about how culture is created via art. and philosophy.
Or is it, that's an interesting one. Is an art an expression of culture or does it create culture?
Yeah, and I think it's a situation where it's become a cyclical thing. But so much of art can influence the way we think.
And right.
When it's, especially when it's partnered with philosophy. So you've got this situation in not just visual arts, but, you know, acting, music, everything. Yep. Because they seem to get us at vulnerable places. I mean, our emotions, we might see and interpret something in a visual piece of art or an
This is why we get into movie soundtracks. Because it represents a particular feeling, like a sensation of watching that movie.
That's interesting. And Nietzsche, actually, he was such a fan of the arts and music, especially because he thought that it had a power to sort of crush through these unrealistic ideals that we have and these falsities, and to I know I'm drawing from Ratzinger here, but they're kind of similar in what they're saying, to wound you and open you up to reality.
Right. Yeah, I think you're absolutely on the money. What's interesting, just psychologically and physiologically, you can actually track the effect of music on the human body. We and songbirds are the only creatures on the planet that we've been able to map that our heart rate attempts to change to match a beat.
Wow. Yeah.
So in terms of like when we hear a beat, we actually try to match it. And and also we've tracked the fact that once music gets over 110 decibels, we make poorer decisions. And and bars actually have music at a certain height because it adds about 10% to the beer sales in a particular organ sales.
It's funny that you say that because, you know, having gone to Notre Dame, walking through the central tunnel, every morning you'd see these people performing music. And as you pass, sometimes two or three different people along the same tunnel.
Right.
But as you pass by each person, you notice everyone's footfalls change to the beat. And I'm very conscious of it. I try to do offbeat walking.
Oh, do you? Oh, that would just drive me crazy.
Yeah, it's amazing. I sort of did it as an exercise.
A rebellion.
Exercise to try to see, you know, and it always felt so uncomfortable. But yeah, I agree. It just seems to be that we fall in line with the beat that's provided.
Yeah. It's really interesting that we kind of not just fall in line with the music, but there is actually a tone to it. So movie producers now look for that sound that goes with a particular part of the movie. Like then they try and get this particular track. And usually the artists are happy to be involved because it then revives interest in the track because it adds a new context to it. Mm. What I've noticed though is that artists are very reluctant to tell us what the song means. So when you go and look up, what does this song actually mean? Mm-hmm. They won't tell you because it expands the, like if they sort of close that loop, it means that all of us who had different theories go, oh, it doesn't mean that. we don't resonate with the song anymore. They want to leave it open to our interpretation.
Well, that's interesting because going back to Hayden's book that we mentioned earlier, he said he was talking about that celebrity and it went to a point where musicians started to tell people what their intent was for a song.
Right.
And now it seems to have gone back to leaving people with that. Now, Guy Sebastian recently released a song called Choir, and he was very open about the purpose for the song. And it was because a friend of his who was instrumental to the beginning part of his journey as, you know, a popular singer, passed away.
Oh.
And so he started writing the song as a sad song, and he said, hang on, this doesn't sum up who he was in my relationship with him.
Mm.
And so he released this song, and for about a week or two, quite a few of my friends and I couldn't get out of our heads. It was just something that really stuck with us.
But see, I don't think naming the purpose of a song actually restricts its audience. So a classic example is Elton John's Candle in the Wind, which he wrote, I think, about Marilyn Monroe, but it was very clearly applied to, even by himself, to Lady Diana. And so
he rewrote it, didn't he?
Sang it, I think. Didn't he sing it at a funeral or some sort of wake or something?
In
other words, just because they've written it for a particular purpose doesn't mean it's not applicable across the board. In some cases, it's just people being vague. But anyway, we need to wrap this up. So is there anything we've missed out in terms of music and our Catholic appreciation of music? Can I throw one question at you?
Yes.
There are some people who would like to say to me that listening to certain types of music is evil, that you just can't do it. As in, this is satanic. You can't, this is what I was raised on, some of this stuff. Rock music is satanic. I think we can put that aside just briefly because, frankly, they're not organized enough to be anything. but in terms of actual, the question comes back to that thing we mentioned in a previous episode, know thyself. Know how the music's affecting you. What am I like? What does it dispose me to? How does it affect me, this music? What's it encouraging in me? What virtues and vices are coming out of me?
I think there's also the element there of intent. What are you, if you're listening to it, what are you allowing it to encourage you?
Right.
In you know, are you looking for validation for this or that or, you know?
Yeah.
I think there's an element in there of the intent.
Yeah, I think good things can come out of, especially heavy metal. I met my husband at Heavy Metal Nightclub. And now we're both Catholic. So, wow. I mean, good things come from it.
Oh, that's another story. That's a story that has to be told sometime. There you go. My wife is so not into heavy metal. In fact, our marriage is a testimony to headphones.
You can get some product placement happening here. Get some sponsorship happening.
Yes, indeed. I've invested in many headphones. Now it's time for a segment we call 1 Minute Wonder. So this is a segment where we share something that we've seen, heard, or experienced this week that made us stop and wonder, something that's made us smile or appreciate life a little more. Box.
Well, I've been in a few conversations with friends over the last week, and it really brought me to wondering about the topic of identity. And it's something that's so huge these days in the media. But a lot of Christians and Catholics, I think, to return back to that concept of identity in God and the solidity of what that means about us, not just individually, but as a culture, as a whole, as a community. So just really, I guess that leads to humility, you know, who am I in relation to God? And so I've just been thinking about that lately.
Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom.
That's right.
That's right. Tara.
So for me, my moment of wonder this week is I'm developing a new friendship, which is quite beautiful in of itself, but she is introducing me slowly to poetry.
Wow.
And it's something I haven't really been exposed to before. And it's just beautiful and in line, I think, with our music episode, how it can really expose you to the deeper parts of being human and reality. There's a particular poem she shared with me called A Tuft of Flowers by Robert Frost, and I just recommend maybe going and have a read of it and reflecting and then being alone with your thoughts for a while.
Well, we need to do more of that thinking, just giving ourselves space to think. I've been listening to an album, an old album actually, by Catatonia called Night is the New Day, and even the title of it gives you an indication that they're trying to make us flip things on their head and make us think about it. I just really appreciate the artistry of it, but it's got me thinking. A lot of individual lyrics, they're one of these annoying bands that don't tell you what they mean, but individual lyrics have got me thinking a lot more. So, yeah, I encourage people to think about what you're listening to. Don't follow my patterns, but but think about what you're listening
to. Do what I say, don't do what I do.
Well, I said don't follow my patterns of music. But
I'm joking.
Students have a couple of times said, oh, what's your playlist? Tell us your playlist. And I've shared it with them. They've gone, oh, okay.
No, thank you.
So, that's it for this week's podcast. If today's discussion got you thinking or arguing with your podcast device, let us know. You can subscribe to the podcast on our website at thiscatholiclife.com.au, or you can tell us what you liked, what you didn't like, what you want us to discuss in future by dropping us a line at info@thiscatholiclife.com.au, or drop us a Facebook message, or contact us via Facebook, Instagram, Discord, or any of the other social media links that you find on our website. Be sure to review us on iTunes and subscribe to the podcast to keep up to date. Remember that this is a uniquely Australian podcast, and we think that's a good idea and an idea worth getting behind. So tell your friends. Before we go, it's time for shout-outs. Tara, you off first this time.
Shout-out to my friend Annetta, who's actually going to start music school soon, and combining that with her amazing ability for philosophy and being a Catholic, I think she's going to do some really good things in that space. So keep an eye out for her.
Fabulous. Ryan.
I want to shout-out to I've been a best man now for 3 weddings, and I want to shout-out to those men, Scott, Brendan, and Iggy. Hope you're going strong.
Nice. So does the best man actually come with a responsibility to...
Yes, I am very intertwined in certain aspects of their lives. Yes.
Right, okay.
Please, not a fourth time.
Yes. My shout out is to those people who in ordinary situations are polite, good-natured and help. I saw an older couple going in an escalator. They stumbled and I couldn't reach them because they were on the escalator going down and I was on the one going up. But several people jumped immediately to helping them up and making sure they were okay. And I think that kind of society is a society we want to live in. So shout out to you. Do those little things. They actually matter. That's all for now. Thank you for listening to This Catholic Life.